We are on part two of our two-part podcast on building culinary confidence for eating wild uncultivated weedy greens that are rich in both macronutrients and essential macronutrients and nutrients. Welcome to the Audible Weed Walk, episode number 48. This is Nina. Today is kind of special because we are resuming live streaming of this podcast. How have you been? Were you able to catch the last podcast where I have covered the steps you need to take before you get ready to cook the wild weedy greens? Let me briefly recollect the key points from that podcast here. They're simple. First, diversify your plate and palate. Number two, know where to source your wild edible greens if you are to purchase them. And number three, sharpen your foraging skill. For this number one, to embrace diversity of local food and especially wild weedy greens, one really has to work on personal barriers. And some of them are good to keep, like, you know, cautionary stand. For example, questions such as, are the greens grown in clean water? They are good to, you know, keep in mind. But we often get stuck with, you know, taste and experience. Oh, you know, I had something as a child and I didn't like, so I will never try. Or we say, I do not like slimy food. I hate okra or lettuce finger and hence will not eat any which are slimy. For example, Malabar spinach, cooked Ceylon spinach or Comelina. Here, knowing about the plants and their benefits may help. As a thumb rule, for example, slimy greens are the ones that heals our gut lining and keep them healthy. I was not just big, but huge on no slime on my plate business. Though I always liked okra, I don't know how. But if I remained at that, I would have totally missed out on eating eru when I was offered that in Africa. Eru is Natum Africanum, comes from a wild vine. The leaves are cooked and served with fufu or other starch. This green is actually now making its rounds. It's grown in several countries and continents. Hands down, it is one of the tastiest, but one of the slimiest veggies that I've ever had. It was offered to me, but I didn't know about it, you know. I couldn't have ordered. But it was offered to me because I was open to eating local food. Until you become the chef you want to be and develop enough culinary confidence, it is good to find out eateries that serves local, seasonal and wild vegetables. Hence, like a financial advisor who keeps on asking one to diversify portfolio, which I have very little understanding about, except I understand the word diversity, my suggestion is diversify your pantry and food and enrich it with local seasonal produce and wild weedy greens whenever possible. As a confident chef, you will need that. The two other points I have covered in some details in my last podcast. True, in purchasing the weedy greens, you are always wondering if the greens were grown in a safe condition. You see, many of the wild uncultivated greens are bioaccumulators. That is, if there is toxin in the soil or water, the plant can take it up. Hence, when you eat them, you get those not so good stuff. Even when they are farmed in an organic farm, one wonders, does it have the same nutritional strength and value as the wild ones? Perhaps not quite, but, you know, it could be close. I would totally resist wild greens grown in greenhouses, perhaps. I'll have to think about that. What do you think? I think part of eating wild green is to move with the season and the surrounding. So growing them off-season in a greenhouse will be somewhat off. That's what my current thinking is. I haven't done much, you know, haven't given much thought about it. That comes to the third point. Whether we are purchasing or foraging or both, we have to keep sharpening our skill to identify, know more about the plants, notice what grows when, and forage. It is not a skill that you will get overnight. As I always say, learn how to identify at least five wild weedy ones so well that you don't even have to think about them. At that stage, you start foraging on them on your own and use similar diligence and caution in approaching and learning about other greens. So now, let's say you are someone who is quite confident about identifying and foraging or sourcing at least a few wild greens. So how will you eat them? You will find that more you know about the plants, more options you'll have how to cook them, because you'll understand their character, the texture, what it pairs better with, etc. For example, food rich in vitamin A should be cooked and served with some oil, because vegetable oil, especially cold pressed, barely heated ones, are vehicles that carry say vitamins like A, D, E, and make it bioavailable to the body. So unless you have a medical condition that requires you to eliminate a certain food, it is best not to eliminate a group or a particular food. It is good to take things in moderation. There are two greens or kiris one easily find in Tamil Nadu right now. They have, because, you know, we recently had some summer rains, and these are amaranth greens, rich in vitamin A, B, C, calcium, potassium, and micronutrients such as iron, magnesium, and potassium. Apart from the ones that show up in the market from farms and also wild, you encounter them all the time on your path, in your garden, in the pot that you, you know, grow something else. Suddenly they pop up on their own. There are about 75 different species and varieties of amaranth, and most of them are wild. In Bengal, you hear about note shag and lal shag, the green and the red varieties. But there are so many in between. You know, so here there is sirukire, which is Amaranthus albus, slightly smaller, leaf shape slightly different if you notice. Then these are these and mulai kires are supposed to be cooling. Now you think mulai kire is just yet another type of amaranth, but there are several species: amaranth dubius, amaranth spinosus, amaranth viridis, and others that come under the umbrella of arai kire. There are red ones too: Amaranthus tricolor, Amaranthus bicolor. Science makes these differences, but in eating we treat them similarly. So mulai, arai, tandu, kirei refers to different stages of growth of the same plant. And why do they have different names? Quite fascinating, isn't it? You see, young shoots of all these species I named just now are called mulai kirei. They are supposed to be cooling, but as the plant matures, they are called arai kire, and they become heat generating and to be cooked differently. Then when they matures even more, they become tandu kire. At that later stage, at tandu kire stage, the stems can be cooked as a distinct vegetable. So the names are distinct and different in different stages. I'm always reminded of David Harmon's book that I encountered whenever I encounter something like this. He is a linguist who had argued that human beings, especially indigenous people, name different parts of, say, the same plant differently when they have different uses for them. Hence, the language represents the knowledge about biodiversity. You'll find them all the time in the wild, and here we just see it even in case of the wild weedy greens as well. So now you have got the greens all set. So to start cooking, what are the ground rules? So pay attention to the pre-processing, how and what part to be cooked. This one part is of such paramount importance that I cannot emphasize enough. Somebody says it's okay to cook, you know, eat it raw, or okay to cook like this, or no need to pre-process, take the most conservative instruction. Mantakali kirei, or the black nightshade is an example. All across the world, wherever they are eaten, they are either blanched or boiled, sometimes boiled repeatedly, and the water is thrown before it is incorporated in cooking and eating. Scientific papers also suggest that at least blanching or boiling and throwing the water is a necessary step. This pre-processing is often skipped in South India, where the green is quite popular. If you are new to this green like me, you at least blanch and throw the water, if not boil. So a bit of caution is not a bad idea. A certain plant depends on how stressed the individual plant is or other growing conditions, for example, season, climate, the water regime, soil, all plays a role on how much chemical concentrates in the plant that we eat. So irrespective of the texture, succulent, mild, etc. that we assume it to be, as a ground rule, eat them cooked and not raw. You can at least, blanch, stir fry, or, more serious cooking, like, add to the soup or something. This simple processing often removes the soluble oxalates from the leaves. As I have mentioned, horse purslane, or Trianthema potula castrum, Ceylon spinach, are those that have, high degrees of water-soluble oxalates in them. And they can be easily removed by just blanching. In case of horse purslane, one also needs to be careful not to eat often and only the young leaves. These are important information to gather before eating a whole lot of them. In some cases, like the jack bean in my book, which is Cannibalia cathartica, pressure cooking and throwing the water not only gets rid of the anti-nutrients, but it makes the bionutrients available. It makes the nutrients, rest of the nutrients available to the body. So more you get to know about the plants, more you can find exceptions to this rule. For example, how you can eat some oxalates raw, gangetic primrose, you can eat some raw, flowers of touch-me-nots, etc. So this comes to the final and the most important tip in building confidence. Keep it fun and interesting. Try out eating turkey berries in traditional Karakorambu, which is a spicy, saucy preparation made in South India. If you find it too spicy, find some other way to process it. Don't say that, don't reject turkey berries altogether because you didn't like the taste of something. Find other safe ways to incorporate it. I simply boil them in tamarind water, drain and add them just like I would add peas and other vegetables in my rice grill or made out of broken sorghum or jowar in my Buddha bowl. One more thing that helps me always to keep things simple. It has some added advantages. Keeping things simple allows you to kind of appreciate the taste of individual ingredients that you're adding. You can always make it more complicated. You can always add more things. But initially, to start simple is quite a wonderful way to get going. Among other things, like paying serious attention on how to pre-process, the wild weedy greens, the most important and the final tip in building culinary confidence is therefore, having some real good time with it. Don't get stuck to the labels of lost food, rediscovered food, etc. There are plants that were not part of our traditional diet. For example, gangetic primrose or Acesthesia gangetica, or candyvine, Antigone and Leptopus. Just because we in our evolution had stopped incorporating the greens in our diet, like we did in those that had arrived before, does not make these plants, these new ones, any less tasty or healthy. So we can build a tradition. Tradition is not something that remains in old books or old set of customs or old recipes. tradition is something that is vibrant, sense of, you know, it kind of caters to the, it is built with the sense of inquiry. It in turn, you know, incites new sense of inquiry and keep it alive. That leads our, something like this must have led our ancestors to explore their surroundings and carve out a healthy living. And of course, wonderful recipes. Time that we add this inquiry to, you know, add more nutritious, healthy, tasty food in our repertoire. With that, I'll end here and I'll see you next week. Stay well and stay safe.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.